Okay. I suspect that my guess is it's very unlikely that any of you thought of the Genesis connection to Paul's discussion of the shift that he's talking about in verses 26 to the end of the first chapter, when he says, for example, that the women gave up their natural function for exchange for unnatural. I don't think that anybody that I know would have thought of, oh yeah, that's about the Genesis 3 story. Okay? Because we're so used to reading that as though Paul is talking about the sexual abuse that occurred in the first century in the Hellenistic world. And of course, everybody knows that pederasty and all kinds of other issues were going on in the first century, and probably the last 10 emperors of Rome were either homosexual or bisexual, one or the other. So we always read the passages as though that's what Paul's talking about. And metaphorically, that's how the passages could be understood. But I want to go back and look at some of the words in those verses in Greek to show you what's happening in the Hebrew connection, because I think it's important to recognize that Paul is doing two things. First, he's talking to the assembly audience and describing what's happening in the outside world. Okay? So in the outside world, of course, all this behavior is going on in the social environment that the Jewish community would have opposed. And Paul is simply recounting God's position on what was happening in the pagan world. But that's just, as far as I can see, that's just the metaphorical symbols that Paul uses for a deeper teaching, and that teaching, of course, is that that something has happened to the way that God designed the whole process in Genesis chapter 2 that fell apart in Genesis chapter 3, and we're looking at results of that in Paul's statements as well. So let's back up for a second and go to these verses, and then let's talk about the Greek words that are used and how strange they are. Okay? And that's strange to us because we're so used to the way that the English translation handles it that we don't think about what was happening in the first century when Paul is writing this in Greek. But let's take a look. Okay? So I want to go back to verse 26. So in verse 26, our English text reads, "For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passages. Passions, for the women exchange the natural function for that which is unnatural." Okay? And what I want to pay attention to is that there are the two words, exchanged and natural. Well, we're going to talk about function as well. Okay? So the first thing we have to notice is that these words are very rare in the Septuagint. In fact, in some cases, Paul's the only one who actually uses the words. Okay? So right away, we know that he's using a vocabulary that wouldn't be common to the people who were already associated with the assembly. So he's got something else in mind. And what I want to point out is that the word that we use for exchange is a word that means literally to change from one to another, and usually associated with some sort of barter, right? So I have an exchange in the market because I give you money and you give me fruit, that kind of stuff. Okay? So the basic idea is to make something other than what it is by an exchange of either value or property or goods or something. Okay? So the first thing we want to pay attention to is that the word is not necessarily used in, and particularly since this verse is about what's happening with women in the Hellenistic age, it's not necessarily used to project the idea of a lesbian relationship. Okay? So when Paul says they exchange the natural function for the unnatural, he doesn't necessarily mean that it's a sexual connotation. Okay? And in fact, if you look at the next word, which is the word physis, right, from which we get the word physics, okay, that word really means the inner quality of a person. Like their inner character, okay? And in fact, in Greek, it's often used for the manner of a person or the inner nature of a person or the character of a person or the true nature of a person. So the whole idea is Paul's not talking necessarily about sexual functions. He's talking about the character of the person. What makes that person who she is? So look what he's saying. That these, and by the way, we should also recognize that lesbianism was not a prominent sexual choice in the first century. So Paul's statement about women is an odd one to begin with. For men, no question. The Greeks started the whole process, and Rome inherited it on the male side, but not on the female side. Females in the Hellenistic world, and particularly in the Roman Empire, were very constrained in their sexual relationships because it was all about inheritance and all kinds of, and legacy and legal issues. Okay, so Paul, when he makes this statement, we might think that he's talking as we normally would translate it and imagine that he's talking about sexual roles, but I don't think that's demanded by the text. In fact, I think that when he talks about the natural character of a woman being exchanged for an unnatural character, he's really talking about, as I said yesterday, what happens when women give up the role that God intended for them and take on a different role. And we see that in Genesis chapter 3 and in the first verse of Genesis chapter 4, where the woman asserts her position by substituting her children for the intended role that she is supposed to have as the Isaiah Conegdo of her husband. Okay, so if Paul's talking in those terms and he's thinking in terms of the Genesis account, what he's saying is that God had a natural function for women, and it was built into their inner character. Their true self was about that role, and that role had been exchanged for something else, and maybe a role of revenge or dominance or something like that, right? So I can understand that whole verse in terms of the Genesis 3 account. But the problem is the next verse. And so let's take a look at the next verse, because there he's talking about males, and we have to see how we interpret that text and how it might be interpreted. Okay, so he says in 27, and in the same way means if the first passage is about the natural character of a person, the inbuilt design that God had in mind, and it being exchanged for something else, then in the same way, now we're going to apply that to males. Okay, he says in the same way also men abandon the natural function. So if I'm thinking in the terms of the Genesis account, what was the natural function? What was the natural function of the male in the Genesis 2 relationship? Well, first it was to remember what God said and to be the one who exercised the requirements of God's direction in the world, right? To be the one who brings about the change in the world based on the ordinance of God. That would be the natural function, the zakar, the one who remembers, okay? So now let's look and see what he says. In the same way, they abandon the natural function of the woman, right? So now here's the point. If Paul is talking about the Isaiah Conegdo, then it's clearly the case that men have abandoned that role because they don't treat the wife as the Isaiah Conegdo. So that would be a misrepresentation of the natural character that God had in mind. And now here's the problem. The next word, burned, because we see that as, oh my gosh, they're overcome with homosexual lust, okay? But what's interesting about the word is it doesn't necessarily mean that. In fact, I'm going to read you a little paragraph here in a second. It only means to have a strong passion for, okay? Now I want to read you a statement from Leon Morris's commentary on this, because I think it's important to recognize what's actually happening in the text. So he says, Paul, he says, basically the word for abandon is rather strong, and Paul uses it only five times. He has quite a bit of unusual vocabulary here, and his words for were inflamed in lust are found only here in the New Testament. Okay? So this is the only place that we find the words, and Paul's the only one who uses them. The former word has the function of burning and seems to be used in the literal sense much more often than in the metaphorical sense. Paul is, in the metaphorical sense, Paul's giving it here. It is a vivid term for much the same idea, although with a different word, for what he says in 1 Corinthians 7:9. Okay? Here, lust is the word for reaching out to grasp something and signifies a strong and eager desire. It can be used in a good sense, but also here in a bad sense. Paul is saying in strong terms that the men were burned up with a powerful but unnatural passion. But now notice what he says. He does not define the evil practice that results. Okay? So this is interesting because we define it. We think it has to be about homosexuality. But what if it's about the burning desire to be in control in opposition to the natural character that God intended in the Genesis 2 account, right? That men got together with other men in order to take control, in order to do exactly what Adam did, which was to exercise control, not over just the women, but to remove themselves from the obligation that God put upon them and act in as though they were, you know, their own judge and jury, okay? Which is what happened in the Genesis 3 account, all right? If we read it that way, then Paul can be referencing what's happening in the pagan world of Hellenism, because clearly the behavior is all around him in the pagan world. But I think he's speaking not just at the surface level, but he's speaking at a much deeper spiritual level, because he's driving the issue all the way back to the Genesis 2, Genesis 3 discussion, where we see the roles that God had in mind are fractured, and the results are chaos, right? The results are betrayal, animosity, chaotic relationships with the children, and just spills over and over and over, okay? So I think that we have to read these two verses, not just a condemnation of the existing social mores of the first century, but we have to read them in terms of the rabbinic thinking of a man seeped in orthodoxy who wants to apply what God's original intentions were and show you what happens when those roles break down. Lucy, did you have something you wanted to add? You have to turn on your microphone.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So if I go back, I have my concordance open, and on 26, when it says, the woman did change the natural use, when I click on the word use, it is G5540, and it says, from 5530, employment, sexual intercourse as an occupation of the body use.
Yes, of course, but that's interpreted by the person who's writing up your dictionary definition. Because if you look at, I'll give you an example, okay? So you want to look at the word use, and let me exchange the word that we translate in NASB as function, okay? And let me tell you what that looks like, okay? That word is used for all kinds of interesting things, like, for example, how valuable something is, what its relationship is, how it's used in common distribution. If you think of the word, how is this thing used, and all of the ways that that could be understood, then you have the idea of the word. Okay. Of course, the way that it's used by Paul here probably refers to not just what's happening in the pagan world, but this deeper idea of a disruption in the natural order. But remember that, as Morris says, this is a very rare kind of thing. So when Paul talks about this, we have to ask ourselves always, what references does Paul have in mind? Because the fact of the matter is, in verse 26, as you pointed out, I mean, if what Paul is saying is true, we should have found lesbian behavior in the first century rampant in the pagan world. And we don't. It's just not part of history. So that must mean that Paul has something else in mind. Maybe he has some sexual relationship in mind, but my guess is probably not. Because as I pointed out, in the history of Hellenism, the behavior of women was tightly controlled, right? And it was not for just sexual reasons, it was because of inheritance issues, right? So yes, okay, your grammar, your lexicon takes you to a definition that's part of the theology that's written into the text. But what I'm trying to do is say, okay, there's another way to look at this. And of course, we have to figure out what that is. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes.
The verse 27 makes me think maybe of the Tower of Babel when all of the men got together to consort together to do a project, and maybe, you know, they let go of the directives of God and just got together and said, this is what we're going to do.
Yes, and that was about controlling the relationship with the divine.
Yeah.
Now, I think that there's a lot of, you know, Paul has this stuff in mind all the time. So there's a lot of ways that we can connect to the Tanakh because of Paul's understanding of what the Tanakh is like that help us understand what he's trying to say to this audience. By the way, Lucy, just so that you have a better understanding of how your lexicon works, I would refer you to the Greek lexicon BDAG, which cites for that word use, usage, usefulness, relations, and function, all of those, okay? And none of those are necessarily sexual, right? It's only a couple of other lexicons like the Leonida and NASB that only interpret it as sexual function, because the word is used for all kinds of different in all kinds of different ways about usefulness and how things are used. Okay. Yes.
Yep. Just one more thing. It's me, Phyllis. Word when it says indecent, how is that? I mean, that word indecent acts. I mean, what are they? What Greek word and what other is that?
Okay. So you're talking about the end of verse 25 for degrading passion.
27. End of verse 27.
27. Okay. Oh, and they committed indecent acts. Okay. So let's see. 27E1. Okay. So indecent means, is the same term that's used for shameful. Okay. So hold on just a second. And I will get to that in 27. Okay. So that word, natural for impairment desire, indecent acts. Okay. Acts which are shameful, indecent behavior, a shameful deed, or unseemly. And the word means the things that are not proper within the context of the moral and ethical assumptions of the community. Okay? So that makes sense, doesn't it? Because if you are part of the assembly of Rome and you're operating on the basis of God's design for men and women, then obviously, anything that brings shame to the original design would fall under this term, right? Let me see if I can give you the term. Hold on.
The Blue Letter Bible Concordance compares it to nakedness and shame, which is Genesis all over again.
Yeah, and in fact, the word means it. The way the word is constructed is it's the word the Greek word for shame with the negative prefix, right? So it literally means something that isn't seemly. And that doesn't necessarily imply sexual, does it? It means something that is outside of the realm of what is normal expectations. We talked about that yesterday, common law, the things that are the normal assumptions of the community. Now, it can be, I mean, Paul can be hinting at what's happening in the pagan world. My only concern there is it doesn't seem to be true of the community of females. And so therefore, I'm going to look at a place where Paul can say this is actually happening with the female population and the male population. And that doesn't happen in the pagan world of Rome. Yeah, Lucy.
Yes, but if I am reading from verse 24, And my version reads, wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts to this
Now you have to go back and ask yourself, what are the Greek terms in 24 for lust and uncleanness? Remember? So lust, our understanding, the English understanding of lust is typically sexual, but that's not the way that the Greek word works. The Greek word is epithemos, and it means an explosive desire, something that is that basically causes you to act in a certain kind of way, right? You can think of the Greek term as extra passionate, okay? Epithemia is desire, but it comes from themos, which means passion. So, for example, I could say, oh my gosh, if I were Greek, I could say I have a real lust for photography. And what I mean is that I have an incredible passion for it, right? So if you read that verse, therefore God gave them over to heightened passions of their hearts. It doesn't necessarily mean sexual, does it? I might very well say that in the Genesis.
Something that consumes you, i.e. the lust for money.
Yes, that's
you're
exactly
consumed.
Right.
That's all you can, that drives you. That is what's driving you, that which is driving you.
Okay, yeah. On my version, it says, epitome is the longing for
and
something.
So in the Genesis 3 account, it's the lust for power, right? Because the male and the female in the account is over who's going to be in control. Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, let's be clear about this. I'm not telling you that you only can read the text in terms of the Genesis passage. What I'm telling you is that Paul is, in my opinion, Paul is giving us two levels of interpretation at the same time. He's saying, okay, let's look at what's happening in our social world. And he makes these statements. And you can apply those, as most English Bibles have, to the sexual mores of the first century in Rome. Okay, but I don't think Paul is only thinking at that level. I think Paul's also thinking at a much deeper level, which has to do with the intended function and natural roles that were designed into God's relationship between men and women. And that's broken as well. And that, in my view, is far more important than simply the sexual mores of Rome, right? Now, one reflects the other. If I break the relationships that are associated with Genesis 2 and 3, I will get the result in the pagan world eventually. And Paul can be saying, you see, this is all coming from what happened in the Genesis 2 and 3 account, because we no longer do those things that God intended men and women to do. We don't have the natural role anymore. We've changed our true character. Okay, but that doesn't mean that we can only think of this passage in terms of Genesis, and we're going to discount all of Paul's condemnation of the pagan world, because we're going to look at the next two or three verses, and he gives a long list of all the things that are the result of this. Okay? So if just keep both of them in mind. Paul, I don't think Paul ever writes at just one level. He's always writing, as the text suggests, with deeper motives all the time. Okay? So let's go now.
Sorry, okay. Skip. Can I just intervene? Hi, Skip. It's Brenda and Tom in Canada. Skip, what you're describing this morning is happening in extreme in Canada. We now have drag queens teaching children in libraries and in schools. So we are seeing what you are saying being done in Canada right now. Fortunately, Ontario is pulling children out of schools to homeschool at quite a rate. It is our prayer and our hope that other provinces will also join in to save the children. This is horrendous, what is happening. We are seeing it live here. So we would ask everyone online to hold Canada in prayer for our children, please.
Yes.
And the United States.
The same thing is happening in the United States. So because, listen, what Paul is describing here in, 2,000 years ago is the extension of what happened in the break of the relationship that God intended that we find in Genesis chapter 2. And it has consequences. And the longer the disruption goes on, the more the consequences become apparent. And if we had time and we went through the history of the Roman Empire, I mean, I literally can take you right through all the steps that happened until the collapse of the Roman Empire, and you see them all happening today, right? Same idea. But I don't think Paul is just saying, oh my gosh, this is a horrible thing about drag queens. I think what Paul is saying is, don't you see that this all started when the design plan that God had in mind, the true character of a man and a woman, was disrupted, was abandoned, and other persona were taken over, and now we're seeing the results of that. Okay? I don't think we can divorce one from the other, but it doesn't mean that we don't see it in society, just like Paul saw it, right? I mean, look, within 400 years of when Paul wrote this, the Roman Empire fell apart. But it didn't fall apart because it didn't have a proper military or it was invaded by the Mongols or whatever. It fell apart from inside. Its value systems collapsed, and then there was nothing left to restrain, to fight against the Mongols and the Visigoths who eventually took it over. Okay, so you're right. I think we see the same thing happening. What I want to do is go to these next verses, because the next verses he starts listing all of the things that he thinks are the consequences of this. Right. So he set you up so that you see the deeper level of what's happening in the Genesis account now being played out in the society, and in the society you see all this kind of dysfunctional behavior going on. And now he says, okay, but it also involves these things. And if you look at the list, we're just going to talk briefly about each one so that you know what the words are that are associated with them. And you can see it starts in, first we have to talk about 28, because he talks about a depraved mind. And that translation is a little misleading. So let's go to 28 just for a second, and you can see what's really involved there. Okay, so my translation in the NASB says, they did not see it to acknowledge God any longer. God gave them up to a depraved mind. Okay? And if I translate the word as depraved mind, what I end up with is a cognitive collapse, right? Because a depraved mind means that I'm not thinking straight. Okay? And of course, from a Western perspective, how I think is the most important thing. But that's not true in a Semitic perspective. How I behave is the most important thing. I can still think wrong as long as I do the right thing, okay? So for Paul to say a depraved mind would make me think, oh my gosh, Paul's moving in the direction of Western philosophy. So let's see what he has in mind, okay? So the word that's translated depraved, we already know, well, kind of we know this word. It literally means an untested, an inauthentic. It doesn't mean depraved like debauchery. It means a mind that has no longer been willing to be tested by God, right? In other words, just like we saw in a previous word where we add the negative particle to the beginning of the Greek word, the same thing is happening here. Adokimos, which means that the word is dokimos, which means to be tested, and in particular, to be watched over, to be esteemed, to be valued. So what Paul is saying is, I haven't given up the wrong thinking. I've changed the way that I think about values. I've changed the way that I think about something that's reliable. I've changed the way that I think about what's esteemed. And that is what adokimos means. It means to shift my value perspective, to shift my idea about what's worthwhile, so that it no longer reflects what God had in mind, right? In other words, it's a word that talks about a collapse of the normal assumptions of the believing community, okay? Because dokimos means that God tested the normal community and found it reliable, esteemed, and worthy. So what Paul's saying is, what happens when they don't acknowledge God is that their value system is no longer reliable, worthy, or esteemed, right? And as Brenda pointed out, that's exactly what we're seeing today. The whole value system is shaking apart. And it's not coming apart because of outside influences. It's coming apart because of inside influences. Why? Because the character that God designed into male and female is no longer being acknowledged. Okay? What I want you to understand in this verse is it's not just about thinking. It's not cognitive, right? And by the way, of course, he uses the word nous for mind, but nous doesn't mean just thinking, because in Greek, it's about perception, it's about knowledge, it's about thinking, it's about understanding, and it also has a moral character, right? It's about acting in right ways, as opposed to what we saw yesterday, the fool, who has fool in Hebrew is a moral term, not a cognitive term. Okay. So when Paul says a depraved mind, he's talking about something that happens that changes the value system of a person so that they start to behave in ways that are inappropriate to the expectations of the community. Okay. Now, gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper. And of course, it's about behavior, right? Excuse me. So, if it's about behavior, then we're set up for his list. And the list begins in the next verse, and we need to know what these words mean, because the translation often doesn't capture exactly what Paul has in mind. Okay? So, notice the first thing in his list. This is verse 29. The first thing is unrighteousness. Okay? So we talked about this. We talked about the word righteous, certainly because we talked about Habakkuk. Remember what we said about righteousness in Habakkuk? Right? That righteousness is alignment with the expectations and moral ethical values of the community as perceived by the Mosaic Code. Okay? So what is unrighteousness? Well, if righteousness is dikai, then unrighteousness is adikai, right? And of course, it means to do everything opposite of what the believing community follows, right? So unrighteousness is not a spiritual status. It's a behavioral status. It's to do those things that violate the law. To be righteous is to be in alignment with the Mosaic Code. To be unrighteous is to be out of alignment with the Mosaic Code. In fact, in the rest of the New Testament, wherever you see the word lawlessness, you should be thinking out of alignment with the Mosaic Code. Okay? Lawlessness doesn't mean that I wasn't following the law of the Roman Empire. I can follow the law of the Roman Empire perfectly and still be unrighteous and still be lawless, because Paul's view of what unrighteousness and lawlessness means is related to Moses. It's not related to the Roman Empire. So the first thing he says is unrighteousness. And of course, that's a behavioral term. Okay. The next thing that he says is wickedness. Okay. And wickedness is poneros in Greek. Okay. And what it means is, this is really interesting. It means to be sorrowful, unhappy, laden with care, bringing trouble, pitiable, poor, unfit, right? Politically useless, worthless. None of those terms would we associate with wickedness, because we think of wickedness as someone who's evil. But in the Greek world, poneros means somebody who was unfit, unuseful, unlucky, worthless, right? Morally reprehensible, okay? All those terms are associated. So, might be better translated malicious or useless or something like that. Okay. Much bigger umbrella of terms than our choice of word for wickedness. Okay. Let's look at the next one. Greed.
Skip a quick question.
Okay. What
reference work are you using to gain these definitions?
I'll show you. This is the abridged version, okay? It's the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament in one volume, abridged. And the reason I have this is because I couldn't bring 10 volumes back with me in the suitcase. But the definitions come from I mean, this is 1,200 pages, right? The full series is 10,000 pages. And this is the standard Greek theological reference material that's used to understand what's happening in the New Testament Greek.
Okay? Great. Thank you.
And by the way, this book is reasonable. The 10-volume set is quite expensive, as you might imagine. But this one is like, I don't know, $80 or $90. And there's another really good reason to have this. It's actually in English.
Okay.
The 10-volume set is mostly in Greek. Okay. So here, all of the references and all the citations are translated for you into English, so you can actually read it. And the very best part about it is it has an English index. So you can actually look up the word greed in English and find the Greek reference. Okay? Yeah, this is a very, very useful book. All right.
Hi, Skip.
If you look at if you're looking at seeing me in the video, the shelf behind you, this shelf up here with all the blue and the, that's the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament. I brought all those volumes. There's 16 of them. So you can understand how, if you're looking at a lexicon that just has a few words and definition, how meager the understanding really is. Okay. So that's why we have to go to stuff like the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament and the Old Testament, because the words are really powerful and they have lots and lots of umbrella meanings. Okay. Somebody else?
Skip, it's me, Adi. I'm reading the New King James Version.
Okay.
And it says unrighteousness, fornication, and wickedness. Fornication is porneia, and wickedness is porneria. Can you expand on that, please?
Okay. So with you're in 29, and it's commenting on wickedness, and it's telling you that poneros.
The verse is slightly different from yours. It says unrighteousness, fornication, and wickedness.
Okay, but it added that word from someplace, because let's go back to the Greek text, okay? Because the Greek text doesn't have two separate words there. The Greek text reads adikia, and then the next word is the word we're talking about, pornia, and then greed, right? It doesn't have an extra word. So your New King James has added a word to try to explain what porneos is about. But what I'm telling you is that the word for wicked and evil doesn't necessarily have a sexual connotation, right? In other words, in the Hellenistic period, the word is, and I'll quote from this, the sense does not undergo much change in the Hellenistic usage. Thus, we find it in meanings of full of trouble, useless, wrong, harmful, contrary, morally bad, and evil. Okay? And even in the Septuagint, the word means ill-natured, unfavorable, prejudicial, sorrowful, unhappy, hurtful, futile. Okay? So, one more time. What's happened in the English text is because of the comments that we went through in verses 24, 25, and 26, 27, the shift in interpretation moved entirely into the sexual realm. So then when we start translating the rest of Paul's terms, we have that framework in mind, and we simply translate according to those ideas, right? Okay. Let's see if I can find in the rabbinic period, pornia was used generally in the moral senses, what is harmful and what is morally bad. And by the time we get to the New Testament, it's used for bad, harmful, unserviceable, and useless. Okay? Paul has this, often uses words in a special kind of way that nobody else does. But the Greek, remember, we're dealing with the Greek audience, so they would hear all of those umbrella meanings, not necessarily the one that we have translated here. Okay? So let's try the next word. Just The next word, of course, is greed. It'd be pretty hard for us to misinterpret that, but who knows? Let's find out. So the word greed there is comes from a word that means covetous or covetous, right? So we think of greed. This is interesting because we think of greed as someone who's possessed with the idea of money, just wants more, more and more. But the actual Greek term gives a nuance to that, right? It's not just having more. It's having more of what belongs to somebody else, right? It's covetous, right? My desire to have more or wanting more or receiving more isn't necessarily morally bad. But the way Paul uses it in the with the Hebrew context is that it's not about just greed. It's about covetousness. So what it says is, I want what somebody else has. Okay? Illegal possession of somebody else's property. All right? Let's take the next one. Malice. Okay? The translation malice, of course, is now the real word for evil. Kaka. Kakos is the Greek word. And it can mean malice, of course, because we have malice aforethought, all that kind of stuff. But it really, this is the real word that should be translated evil. And what's interesting about it is, in the Greek sense, it isn't a word that says this is morally reprehensible, because it also means unserviceable, incapable, weak, and ruinous. Right? So in Greek, the concept of kakos, morally evil, also means not worthwhile, not useful, something that destroys you, something that has no value, right? It's all that kind of stuff combined. Okay? So you can see the translator is forced to choose one word, of course. But if we use the Amplified New Testament, we'd have to include all those words. So Paul isn't just telling us these are bad things. He's saying that they're also things that have no value, that they don't work, that they're useless to us. Okay? All right, let's look at the next one. Full of envy. Okay? Full of envy. And the word for envy, hold on just a second. The word for envy is pathonos. And it literally means ill will or jealousy.
Yeah. Okay? I have stuff with jealousy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Jealousy. Right? So we want to be careful about this because there's actually a difference between jealousy and envy, isn't there? Right?
Yeah.
For example, you remember all of the passages in the Tanakh where it says that God is a jealous God. Does that mean that Paul would say, oh my gosh, God needs to repent because he's jealous? Is that the same word? No. What's the difference between jealousy and envy?
You have something that belongs to me. I'm jealous because you have something that really belongs to me. Envy means you have something and I want that.
Right. Envy is the same as covetous. You have something and it's yours, but I want it. I envy it. Okay? I envy having your possession. Jealousy is you have something that actually belongs to me. So we can say God is a jealous God because he's jealous over Israel. Israel belongs to him. And the other nations should not enjoy Israel's obedience or alignment because that literally belongs to God, right? But God is never envious, right? So we have to make that distinction. And when we have this translation, which says envy, we have to be sure that we understand that it's not the same as saying that I want something back that belongs to me that somebody else has. Okay? All right, let's try the next one. Of course, murder. And murder, you know, in the biblical account, murder is not the same as killing, right? You knew that, of course. They're two different words in Hebrew. But in this particular case, murder here is the idea of to be slain, or to slaughter with without provocation. Okay? No, not without provocation, without legal, what's the right word that I'm looking for? Without legal authority, right? Because obviously the Bible believes in capital punishment, but it doesn't consider that murder, because that's a punishment under the law, right? Okay, next one. Strife. In my New Testament translation in the NASB, it's strife. But in Greek, the word is iras, and it means quarrel. It means contention, debate, strife, variance, disagreement, anger in argument. It means, I just finished a little while ago reading a book by Douglas Murray called The Strange Death of Europe. And in that book, he talks about trying to have a discussion with a group of people about what's happening in the political environment in Europe, and having one of the people in the other group say to him, I don't care about the facts. I don't care what you think. You know, that's strife, right? It has nothing to do with debate. It has to do with contention. And as I've told some of my American friends, I'm glad I live in Italy right now, because the United States is in such strife, such disharmony, such aggravated hatred toward others because of a difference of opinion, that there's very little room for rational discussion, okay? So that's what Paul is saying, that as a result of the breakdown of these relationships that started with a natural order that God had in mind, these kinds of things are happening. And one of those, of course, is this idea that you can't have a you can't have a discussion with anybody, because all you end up with is contention and wrangling and quarrel. Okay? By the way, Paul lists this, has the same list like this in Galatians. You remember, I think it's in Galatians 5. And some of these same words he uses again when he's talking to the Galatians assembly. Okay? How about the next one? Deceit. This is an interesting word. Okay? So, deceit in the Greek text. Dolos, deceit. And this is really interesting, because the word comes from the idea of bait, right? It comes from the word for a decoy. You bait somebody, right? You get them to think one thing when something else is actually happening. And what's really interesting is that this, of course, takes us all the way back to the first couple of sentences of the third chapter of Genesis, because the serpent deceives. Paul even says that later in the letter, right? Eve was deceived, but Adam sinned intentionally. Eve was deceived. That means she was baited. She was presented a decoy. Something else was actually happening, right? And of course, this word, in Greek, is also associated with guile and subtlety and craft and all the kinds of things that we find in the first sentence of the verse of the third chapter of Genesis. Now, the serpent was the craftiest creature. And what does that mean? Well, if we were writing it in Greek, we would say he was the most duplicitous, right? He was able to present one thing and make it look like something else. So that's what Paul has in mind here. So it's not simply deceit. It's the idea of presenting bait to someone. Okay? Next, malice. And of course, we want to know the difference between deceit and malice. So in Greek, the word malice comes from the same word that we saw for evil, kakos, right? So here we have kakotheites, which is a particular kind of evil. And in this case, malice, of course, is evil toward, it's the intentional evil toward someone, whether they recognize it or not. Okay? It means a perversion toward intentional wickedness. So someone could be wicked accidentally, couldn't they? They could do something harmful without realizing it. But they can't do this without realizing it, because it's intentional. Okay.
My translation is ill will, which I think is.
Ill will, yes. That's also close. Yeah. Ill will. Okay. And then it says they are gossips. And of course we can recognize this because the whole idea of this is slander. Right? In fact, it's associated with, it's really interesting because it comes from a Greek word that means whisper. So it's something that you say in secret to someone else, of course, that's harmful to a third person, right? And the intention here is that it's, you know, it's something that you hide from the person that you're harming, but it has the same kind of effect. Okay, so now we got to go to verse. Do we have anybody have any comments on those? We're going to go to verse 30. Paul continues the list. All right, we're just trying to amplify the words so that we understand exactly what all these things are that he's saying are going to happen. Okay, so he's just said gossips, which is about whispering, and then the very next word that he uses is slander. So is that a different kind of word? Actually, this is another form of another derivation from a word like kakos. Here it's katalaos, which means basically to speak against, a backbiter. Okay? So malice is something that's done in secret for the harm of someone else. Slander is done in public, right? It's to talk against someone with the intention of harming them. Okay? And the next one, of course, is haters of God. And we want to know what the word there means. And for that word, we're looking at the idea of, it's actually comes from a word that means impious. To hate God is to act impiously or to speak impiously. It's to be insulting. It's to basically, it's to be out of alignment with the things that God wishes. Okay? And here, it's the combination of two words, one that means to hate, and the other, of course, is theos, for God. And the one for hate is a word that means to have animosity toward. But it's more than it's. I see that word. The English equivalent that I have here is odious, something that's repugnant. Okay. So next one that he uses is insolent. Is that what you have in your translation? I have slanders, haters of God, insolent. Yes, insolent. Okay. And here we have the negative of, we don't have a negative. In this case, the word is a word that you're familiar with. At least the root is hubris, right? So it means not just insolent, but arrogant. Okay. And of course, in the Greek terms, you can think of the myth of the man who thought that he could fly up to the heavens with wings. But the whole idea of hubris is to see yourself as more important than you really are, is to think of yourself more more worthy than the actual status that you have. And in my lexicon, it says that the Hebrew originals for this word are the word of the group that's gil, or to denote loftiness or pride or arrogance. It's presumptuousness. Okay? We have plenty of examples of that in the political world today.
Skip, do you have the word violent in there?
I have what?
The word violent in there. In the New King James, you have backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud.
I don't have the word violent in there. I have okay. insolent, arrogant, and boastful.
Yeah, that's what I have.
Arrogant, okay. of course, is to think of myself, it's hubris to think of myself as more important than I am. Boastful means to proclaim my status of worthy yeah. at the detriment of others, right? To be boastful. And by the way, that has a good sense as well, because don't you remember that Paul in his own letter says that he boasts in his obedience to Christ and in his dedication, right? So it has both good and bad connotations. Inventors of evil is interesting because inventors of evil comes from a word that means to contrive or to discover, okay? So there are, you can recall the prohibitions in the Proverbs about those who are contrivers and those who manipulate things in order to accomplish their own end. And that's in the background of this word as well. It can mean something positive, of course, but it can also have this negative connotation that Paul's trying to use it for here. Okay, and last one, disobedient to parents, which is really interesting. Disobedient to parents. And of course, that word is, for disobedience is a word that usually means to seduce or corrupt or persuade in the wrong sense. Okay? So in this case, disobedience is the negative of this. Obedience is to convince, to persuade, to trust, and disobedience then would be to convinced to do the wrong thing, to persuade to do the wrong thing, or to not trust. Okay? And that takes us to the end of verse 30, but Paul isn't done with his list. He still has a few more words that he adds in 31, and he says, without understanding. Okay, so now we would expect that this would be the most cognitive of all the words, because, of course, he wants to say something about their mental condition, but the fact of the matter is that even here, the word isn't cognitive. It isn't necessarily cognitive because the word comes from the same word that we get the word synthesis, right? Synesis, synteme, and of course, then it's the negative of that. So what he's saying is, it isn't that they're without understanding. It's that they lack the ability to come together in agreement, right? To be without understanding is to be opposed to agreement in a group. And of course, this is the anti-community word. Okay? And then just two more. Untrustworthy, three more. Untrustworthy, and of course, we should get that one right away, right? Because trust is a word that we're quite familiar with in Hebrew, emunah. Untrustworthy means not keeping a promise, not keeping a covenant. It doesn't have anything to do with not feeling that it specifically is about a covenant relationship or a promise relationship or an agreement relationship, not necessarily about simply being untrustworthy, right? This particular word is the word for faithless, and it's interesting that it's in the same form as the previous word without understanding. This is untrustworthy, and it means literally to not keep a covenant agreement. So it couldn't be any more Hebraic than that. Okay, unloving. Yes.
Can I just add to without understanding, which is asynetos in Greek, if you go to the Hebrew, it's the word is nabau, which means the one that breaks the covenant, that breaks the rules.
Yeah, good point. It's not simply about being in disagreement with the covenant, who actually breaks it. Yeah.
You can find that use in the Book of Kings with David. And Abigail and Nabal, who broke the covenant. It's why his name is, that's his name, because we're sure his parents didn't name him that. But that's the name that he was given.
Yep. Yeah. And it's important for us to see that The word is a covenant relationship word. That's what's really important here, because it isn't as Paul's not just saying, hey, listen, you can't trust people in a business community in a pagan world because they have the wrong, you know, connection with the true character that God designed. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is these people on the outside of this assembly are literally covenant breakers. And for him, the issue is always about relationship to the covenant. So here he picks a Greek word that specifically relates us back to the Hebrew idea of keeping the covenant. Okay? Now let's look at the next one, because this is really interesting. Yeah. You know that there's question?
Well, would that also bring back to the whole idea of chesed, which is all based on covenant?
Yeah,
so
I think
so.
You're
bringing covenant of right. God and also in the community.
Yeah. And of course, what Paul's only doing is explicating what happens in the social environment when you no longer are following, quote unquote, the good news of God from the first verse. Okay? Let's look at the next word, though, because the next word is really interesting. You know that there are four different words for love in Greek. Okay? And you might think, oh, this means without, I just went completely blank. The usual Greek word that everybody talks about for love.
Eros.
Agathos. What is
agape?
Agape. Yeah, yeah. So you might think that this word is without agape, but it's not. The interesting thing about the choice that Paul makes here is that he chooses the word the Greek root is storge, right? Which is not the sense of a self-giving love, but a love that doesn't have natural affection, and in particular about families. And what that word is used, not just about brotherhood, that's filio, right? Not about my love for an idea or a passion or a possession, that's eros. Not about self-giving love, that's agape. But in this case, storge, which is the love that is associated with family connections. Look what he's saying. When all these things break down, the internal structure of a family collapses, right? In other words, they are unloving to their own family members. Okay? Very different than this universal idea of agape, unloving because they don't give of themselves. That's not what he has in mind. He's very specific about this. Okay, and the last one. Of course,
my translation says heartless.
Yeah, heartless. I see that too.
I have foolish, faithless, heartless, and ruthless.
Yes, but it's not simply heartless toward anyone else. This is a family-connected word, so it's as though I no longer. And you can see the progression, right? Because he's just said that they are disobedient to parents, and now he's going to specify what that means. What it means inside the family is they've stopped caring for each other. The family unit has broken down. Okay? And then, of course, the last one, unmerciful. And for that, we of course, you're going to know what that word is if I talk about it in Greek, in Hebrew, because it's the very first word, compassion, that God talks about himself. When he passes by Moses and says, the Lord, Lord, compassionate, merciful, etc., right? And the typical translation of mercy in Greek is eleos. But if you do the background and you work your way back through the etymology, you will discover that the most typical translation of eleos for a Hebrew cognate is hased. So at the end of this whole thing, he says, okay, by the way, they don't show hased. Yeah, 280 times it gets translated mercy. But if we're going to read it backwards, we need to know that what he has in mind here is not simply just being compassionate towards somebody, but the whole process of the fourfold relationship of chesed. Okay? And we can finish this chapter. And although they know the obedience of God, and those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give merry or hearty approval to those who practice them. Okay? And for that, I wanted to talk about the three, we talked about this once before, but we need to talk about what he has in mind and the three different versions of fool. Right? In Proverbs, there are three kinds of fools. We mentioned this before, right? There's the fool who is the evil. He is the one who deliberately disobeys. Okay? He knows what's right. That's what Paul's talking about. And he deliberately disobeys. But there's also the Nabal, who not only deliberately disobeys, but encourages others to do the same thing. And that's what Paul's talking about here. And in Proverbs, Kasil is the other one. Kasil is the one who's just ignorant. Okay? He's the least likely, he's the most likely candidate to be redeemed, the Kasil, because he just doesn't know. So I give him moral instruction. He recognizes it. He does it, right? The Evil is the one who says, hey, I know what I'm supposed to do, but you know, I don't care. Okay? The Nabal is the one who says, I know what I'm supposed to do. I don't care. And by the way, you come along with me and we'll do it together. And that's what Paul's describing here, right? Because he says, not only do they know and they don't do it, but they give hearty approval to others. And why does he use that at the end of this long list of consequences to the breakdown of the natural order? Why does he use this one? Because the Nabal is the one that Proverbs says don't have anything to do with them. They're beyond the pale. They can't be redeemed. At that point, you give up. You're better to walk away, right? So now we've reached the end of the first chapter, and we see how Paul has directed this whole operation, the whole setup for the rest of the letter, okay? Because the rest of the letter is just amplification on what he's already said, okay? The rest of the letter. So he starts off with, hey, I'm here to tell you about the good news of God. The good news of God is that God cares. And not only does he care, but he put in place the Messiah so that we can understand how the text is supposed to be interpreted for us. And all that is a blessing to not just the Jewish community, but to all the Gentiles who come into the Jewish community, because now you're going to, as Peter says, learn about Moses. Then everything else that he does in the first chapter is reference back to Moses, reference back to Moses. All along the way, he's telling you, listen, we already have the instructions about how this is supposed to work, and we all know that. Now, let's look and see what happens in the pagan world where they don't have these instructions, or where they have abused these instructions, and you see all this breakdown of society, breakdown of family relationships, untrusting of each other, all the chaos that's going on in society. And he says, in my opinion, that's a reflection of what we already know about from Genesis chapter 2 and 3. And once we have that settled, and we recognize what position we're in, different than the pagan society, now let's go and talk about what's going to happen inside of our assembly. And now we start chapter 2. And chapter 2 is, let's look at the progression of what's happening in the assembly, because he ultimately wants to get to the point where he says, now you guys need to behave according to this plan, according to the expectations of the community that God put in place way back there at the beginning. Okay? Comments, questions before we wait until next week? We got enough to think about now?
Yeah, Skip, it's Dave. It's just amazing as we go through these last verses how we've always thought, well, this is the people outside the church, outside the community, but no, it's not. It's all about inside the walls.
Yeah, that's true in the sense of what we see happening now. But from Paul's perspective, he's not writing to the people inside the walls and telling them that they have all of these behaviors, because what he's saying is, you came from that kind of world. You're now in this assembly. So now start behaving according to the paradigm that you've adopted. And that's what the rest of the letter is going to be about. But at least he shows us what the stark contrast is. Once you give up the paradigm, all these other things are eventually going to happen.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's a condemnation of what we see in our world today, because we're basically in the same position as the Roman assembly. We're looking outside and saying, oh my gosh, look what's happening, right?
Yeah, Skip, this falls into the idea that it's a letter and it's one side of a conversation, and it's we kind of have some understanding of what's going on in Rome, but we don't know the real personality of the congregation he's speaking to. And we're having to interpret all that. It just keeps rolling through my brain.
Yeah. And as we go along in the rest of the letter, we're going to learn more and more about what was happening in that assembly, because Paul starts talking about specific issues that he wants to address in the assembly. But this is sort of the general picture. You know, you guys are not the same as this outside world because you have a paradigm shift. Now, wherever that paradigm shift isn't being put in place properly, oh, now you're starting to look like the outside world. So let's get that fixed.
Maybe it's not, you guys aren't the same. You aren't supposed to be the same.
Yeah, that's more like it, yeah.
But Skip, we're talking about the paradigm, but in our Christian assemblies, we're not linked to that paradigm. We've broken ties with the paradigm centuries ago.
Yeah, that's right. And so we wouldn't be surprised to find that some of these things which the church today says all belong in the outside world are in fact, as Dave said, already inside the walls. Because we've stepped away from what I would say is God's natural function of men and women. And I don't mean, you know, the sexual one. I mean the way that God designed you to function in Genesis chapter 2.
Yeah. The other thing is when you hear Paul saying God gave them over, it makes me think of Pharaoh. Like when God gave Pharaoh over to his pride, you know? He had a drive that was natural, but then he gave him over to the extreme of that when he dealt with the Egyptian,
I think that's a really good point because you don't want to think that God initiated the collapse of this. And that isn't what happens with Pharaoh either, because of the 19 occurrences where it talks about and God caused Pharaoh to do something. It doesn't exactly say that, but the idea in Hebrew is that God had a restraining hand on Pharaoh's natural proclivities. And all he did was remove the restraint so that Pharaoh's natural incentive, personal incentive, to become the kind of person who would be in total disobedience to God, just blossomed. And the same idea here. It isn't that God takes these people and gives them over to Satan, right? That's not what happens. All he does is remove the protection that he's had over them to prevent their natural affinities from exploding. And as soon as he takes his hand away, then when now Paul says, here's the list of all the things that happen. All right, good point.
Skip, good morning. Yeah, good morning, Skip. Larry and Phyllis here. Yeah, this teaching reminds me a lot of what they talked about in Acts 15, and you may have even mentioned that earlier in this study when they said that people will have to abstain from these three or four things now that you're part of this community. So it's a very similar teaching. And for some people here, this may not be a new paradigm, but for those like me that was challenged by this change of paradigm years ago, it can be a real struggle. But if you go to Acts 15, it was very clear that these people, these newcomers to the community that were starting to follow the belief in the Mosaic Code and the Jewish people and their lifestyle, when he goes on to say they'll have to abstain from these things because they can't keep living the way they're going to live and be in our community. After all, isn't Moses taught in the temple every Sabbath, right? So he knows that they're going to learn about all these things, but for now you have to quit doing this.
Yeah, that's right. And what's interesting is in Acts 15, he isn't talking about all these social and moral behaviors. He's talking about four items of pagan religious worship. And he says you can't bring those ideas of pagan religious worship with you. Those are the things you have to let go of. Then we'll go to work on the rest of it. Okay? So in this case, Paul isn't dealing with the issues of pagan worship, although Larry's point is very good. The Gentiles would have come with some of those expectations because they came out of a Gentile world. They came out of a pagan world. But in this case, what Paul's saying is, you recognize what was happening in your social world outside. Now let's start focusing on how that changes on the inside. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay, then I guess we're off until next week, and we'll go at it again in 2023, just like we started off the year. Okay, very cool.